Postcard from Lille, Part 10, by Always Worth Saying. Image. USS Bigley and the author in California. Previously I mentioned my backs and forwards between the north of England across the Atlantic to North America. You may recall the Drink the Airfare Mile High Club. These happened between the Pan Am bombing and the end of Gulf War I. In fact, my last day ever in the United States was the 28th of February 1991. A date you may see on the rim of Gulf War I veteraness medals. I was supposed to be in the United States a few years earlier but was refused entry. I was never told officially why, rather handed a piece of paper containing the list of most usual reasons. Suffice it to say that if you're a communist convicted Nazi war criminal drug addict with no money and an infectious disease, smuggling plants into the US of A, then your employer, like mine, has wasted an airfare. Under a different set of circumstances years later, and a few weeks before the end of Gulf War I, I had been in San Francisco. Arrival was by train to Oakland and then by bus across the bridges to San Francisco itself. Alighting at the bus station, I couldn't help but notice a considerable amount of damage. There was stenciled graffiti everywhere insisting upon no blood for oil, self-explanatory, and find a cure, medical research not war. There were broken windows and overturned cars. I inquiries of a policewoman standing on the sidewalk dressed in riot gear. She looked me straight in the eye, without a hint of humor, and with an absence of irony that only an American can muster, told me that, "There's been a pacifist riot, sir. Welcome to California." A few years earlier during the Iran-Iraq war, a Turkish pacifist on the dockside at Mersin in the eastern Mediterranean might have chanted, "No bones for watches." Let me explain. I have traveled across the Balkans and Turkey to Adana'm near the border with Syria. It lies on Iraq's run between the East and Iraq, smuggling atom bomb components to Saddam Hussein via the port of Mersin. And it's muggins' turn to do something about it. Adana bus station was a ramshackle piece of rough ground covered in buses. Domuses, local name for large taxis, and taxis. Boys ran between the vehicles hawking the routes. I wasn't going to Iskenderun or Aleppo. Rather, I was listening out for Adana. Tarsus. Mersin! There was plenty of choice. Numerous old jalopies, many without a windscreen or, worse still, with windscreens pockmarked with head-shaped bulges and forehead-sized cracks beckoned. I paid my few pennies and off we set. The last sight I can recall on leaving the city was a butcher sitting in the gutter peeling the skin off a beheaded calf. After that, the view was of the fringes of the cotton fields, often bordered by oil pipelines. From Adana to Mersin is about 40 miles, with Tarsus being at the midway point. I'd decided to break my journey there as it is an interesting place of biblical significance and also might allow, if challenged, a plausible excuse of being in that part of Turkey as a pilgrim, tourist, or even historian. The Turks weren't all that interested in classical times as it wasn't Turkey then, their history lying further east with the migrating Turkish tribes of the steppe, and their religion originating to the south in the holy places of Islam. Very often, Greek and Christian artifacts were just piled up in a heap, ignored. Alighting at Tarsus, I made for its lunar park for a stroll and a think. Sweet tea prices hit an all-time low at the equivalence of 1/8 of a penny a glass, served in the most delicate glasses and from a silver salver by very noisy and inquisitive children in pantaloons and embroidered shirts. I don't think I'd seen another white person since Ankara, and my blue eyes attracted attention too. Another good reason to break my journey was to kill time and arrive in Mersin more anonymously after dark. There were a couple of notable attractions to see: Cleopatra's Arch and St. Paul's Well, which is a good excuse to dwell upon that biblical significance. Now, St. Paul was an interesting chap, and we are familiar with his story from the Acts of the Apostles. They say that if you throw enough muck at a wall, then some of it will stick. Likewise, if enough people are inspired by the new and rapidly spreading faith, then sooner or later one of them will be a rather difficult, bad-tempered and very determined Greek, Jewish, Roman citizen from Turkey who hates Christians, and isn't he afraid to rewrite what God has just said? Let us go down that list and see what we think. We can dismiss Turkey right away, as it wasn't Turkey in those days. It was under Greek influence, so having understood that, let us cross that off too. As for Jew, the Holy Land isn't far away. Tarsus was a port in those days, before the bay had silted up, and Hebrew people of Israelite inclination do tend to wander. Am I allowed to say that? As an aside, I can recall a wonderful squadron leader who said the most outrageous things when non sequitur calling the numbers on squadron bingo night, 4 and 3, send them back, and got away with it every time by suffixing it with "Am I allowed to say that?" question mark via a straight and innocent face. We LL cross off Christian hating too, as that ended during St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. That leaves us with Roman citizen, despite Tarsus being thousands of miles from Rome and Paul being a Greek Jew. Let us see if biblical references to Tarsus help. All refer to nothing but location except when St. Paul drops it into the conversation in order to ensure that he is allowed to speak in his own defense at the temple in Jerusalem. Generations of biblical scholars have agonized over how St. Paul could be a Roman citizen and why he should be allowed a special status by being from Tarsus. Dear reader, here is what to tell them while picking that muck from pepper over the roast swan in an Oxbridge refectory, while a string quartet plays Brahms from the gallery. Tarsus, and her inhabitants, had a special status because of an important skirmish that the Romans won there. A bit like wartime Walter or the Duke being awarded the George Cross. I think that's what a 10-year-old Turkish boy was trying to tell me while serving my tea on the parched grass at Luna Park. Back on the bus to Mersin, having flirted with the official secret sect, we now hit it like a brick wall. The mighty ship HMS Postcard from Lille sits marooned on its reef. Suffice it to say that Saddam Hussein never developed his atom bomb, and the less the courier knows the better. What happened on the way to the docks need not be your concern, and I've been invited to forget about it ever being mine. Regular readers will have noticed a clanking handover of material in Istanbul when I bought the digital watches from a spiv, for a subsequent barter, and also hints at a trade in old human bones for medical students. Let us just say that I left Mersin without the watches and with a well-secured box. It took a bit of getting into, and hopefully in the process I didn't wreck anything. It was too big for my Bergau's pack and very square, which made the corners protrude. It was just too obvious that something was being concealed and gave me a very bad feeling indeed. Inside were those ancient, bleached and cracked, anonymous, harmless human bones to be sold to medical students in the West. I wrapped them up in my clothes and towel and soap bag and secured them in my pack. I left Turkey by a different route, that this story need not trouble itself with, by an unusual route known only to myself and the mice. Image. Traveling companion. A week later I was leaving a nondescript building, just outside the embassy district of a Mitteleuropean capital sans la bones. Job done. What follows is speculation based upon an old fool reflecting on life as he whisks through the French countryside to Lille decades later. As we also established earlier, the less the courier knows the better, but I would say the electronics in the watches were material for Saddam's project, fed into his supple chain, doctored to wreck what he was doing. Amongst the millions of connections on the extracted semiconductors were groups which could instruct the circuit board they were inserted into, to make a component a quarter of a millimeter too wide, run a centrifuge at 50 revs out of 50,000 too fast, open a valve a minute early, or set a shaped charge off 1/50,000 of a second too late, and in doing so sabotage Saddam's nuclear ambition. If you think you know better, for all I know, you may be right. A friend tells me that entry into the secret world is via the correct public school and college education combined with a pleasant, self-effacing, rather anonymous demeanor and couple of good connections. Obviously it helps to be able to live rent-free in central London. One envies those army officers who have nothing left after rent and mess spills, at least they've been fed and watered. Beyond that, I am told, the requirement is to be either too clever by half, intelligence branch, or frankly a bit dim, executive branch. The two can be separated by an exam. I should imagine that these take place in a function room at a Lamy's coach trip from the province's weekend hotel in an unfashionable part of London owned by a friend and former employee of the service who sank, literally, his inheritance and meagre pension into a hotel. Suffice it to say that the DFG are having a terrible time in the DRC in their fight against the GDF, also allied to the GFD. They're wavering allies. The FDG have plenty of RPGs but no APCs. Meanwhile it's high noon at the airport, APT. The Cs have been confused with the SA7s which were meant as a swap for the SA9s, with the untrustworthy FGD acting as go-betweens. In a meeting with all these TLAs, three-letter abbreviations, our chap on the ground has 30 seconds to decide who to, on behalf of Her Majesty, poke in the eye and who to promise all manner of things to, before, across a period of time, rearranging their expectations. Believe it or not, some people soak all of this up, understand it and extrapolate accurately from it in an instant. Others, including your author, I would imagine, baffle themselves, and get a lower mark than they would have if they had simply picked random answers. At the other extreme are those who get AAA double plus plus and might find themselves being put on a Middle East desk. Which brings us to the box of bones. I am not an expert, and don't want to be, on the damage done to the human body whilst being tortured to death or of weathering bones to make them look a lot older than they really are, but I would wager they were the remains of a hostage mistreated beyond human endurance returned to allow a grieving family to have something to bury in a weighted coffin in a finer, greener place than the bloodstained dust of the Near East. The barter for sabotaged computer chips concealed in watches being conducted via a web of friend S, enemy S and enemy S of friends which only intelligence branch can understand and manipulate. Now it's fashionable to provide alternate endings, and computer simulations and streamed videos, I understand, allow for such, so let's not prevent writing and reading from denying ourselves the same. Perhaps with that easy stupidity of a midshipman may I offer you the following endings. Stopping Saddam Hussein's bomb saved countless lives by preventing a confrontation of nuclear-armed warring factions in the Middle East. Stopping Saddam Hussein's atom bomb cost countless lives by removing the nuclear deterrence to war from the factions in the Middle East. Take your pick. To be continued. Copyright Always Worth Saying 2019.